Good evening, listeners. It is the 22nd of July, 2018, and you're tuned in to 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is currently just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday, that can only mean one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Lori Lutz.
And I'm Adrian Gallo. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student at Oregon State and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out all about the awesome things going on at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our upcoming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests, and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. Tonight, we are joined by Akash Kanagula. Welcome, Akash. Can you just get us started off by telling us a little bit about your research?
Hi. Thank you for inviting me, and I'm Akash, and my research is about light-matter interactions, and I do the fundamental study and apply these for applications like display devices and DNA sensing, etc. So to give a brief description, I work on something called quantum dots and plasmonic nanostructures. So if you have, you have a metal substrate, metal, and metal is full of electrons. So when you hit this metal with photons or light, this light is going to disturb the surface of this metal, which is full of electrons, and these electrons will start oscillating. So because of these oscillations, the surface will have something called as electron cloud, or in other words, called as surface plasma. So I study the more details of this interaction of light and matter, which is nothing but the metal in this case, and utilize this surface plasma for, like I said, display devices and DNA sensing.
So for the first, let's kind of break it down into something that, you know, my dad would really appreciate. He loves watching soccer games, mm-hmm. and, you know, the thing he's really after is getting the best video that he can. Mm-hmm. And using some of this technology is kind of still in its infancy stage, but essentially we're going to be able to, in the near future, get better display devices, whether it be TVs or mobile devices, but also these mobile devices and consumer products will essentially also use less energy, which I think you're going to talk about in the, coming forward. So our carbon footprint can also be much, much smaller with the advancements that you're working on.
Yes. So to describe more details about how this works or where the path is right now, so the materials which are used in these display devices, for example, in the current generation of display, it's OLED displays, or you can see a brand new televisions called QLEDs, which are out by Samsung. So the difference between these each generation of displays are the materials like organics, OLEDs, or QLED quantum dots. So what I do is these materials like quantum dots emit the three colors of light, red, green and blue, which together we can come up with multiple colors. You turn on all the colors at the same time, it becomes a white color, or R plus G, a different color, so something like that. And what we do is we take these materials and we place it near the electron cloud or the surface plasma, which I mentioned. And because of this electron cloud or surface plasma, that will act as an amplifying agent for the emission. And instead of giving a brightness of X, the brightness will be like 10 times to 100 times brighter than what it has to do just because of this environment which we provide. So that's a path for energy efficient display devices. And yes, you're right. Eventually, we will be seeing thinner displays which can be transparent. And all of these displays require this environment for a better efficiency and so on.
So we're talking a lot about these displays and like televisions. And for anyone that has bought a television in the last couple of decades, you know, all these acronyms are so, for me, confusing even. You know, it's like LCD and LED and you know, now we have like quantum LED and all of this. So, and what you're working to do is provide something that's more efficient, but it's also improving the resolution of the display.
Yes, so there are two factors for display devices. One is the resolution. Definitely, we want a highest possible pixels in a particular display for a better resolution. But the second and the most important thing is the number of colors which we can emit through this display. A human eye can capture all the possible colors in the visible spectrum, and we cannot emit all these colors through a display. So we started off with a black and white television long ago, decades ago, and we moved on to a portable and then LCD and plasma TV, OLED and QLED. So what is getting better with time is not just the resolution, but also the number of colors which are displaying out of these televisions are more. That's why we can find the better display. So, and the target of this technology is if we can see the television the way we see outside, the same number of colors which we can capture through a television, that's the final goal of the display technology, and that's our research will put a step ahead in this technology. Yeah.
So I think we talked about this before, and I want to take a huge leap forward just to kind of see the potential for this technology, and then we'll come back into where we are today. But one potential use of this is to use these displays in airplanes, where instead of having windows that are actually really energy inefficient because of a variety of things like wind resistance, and then you have to cool that area, and then you have to manufacture it that way. There's all kinds of holes everywhere. And then plus not everybody can see Mount Hood when you're flying into Portland. Only people on one side of the airplane can actually see it. But in the future, a potential use could be to apply these inside of airplanes so that everybody in the airplane can seemingly look outside, but actually they're just seeing like the best part of outside. Like if they're going over Mount Hood, then the entire airplane can see Mount Hood. But really, it's just a tin capsule that is far more energy efficient and way more streamlined. Is that sound like one
yes.
of the...
Yes. So that's part of an upcoming technology called transparent displays, where we have right now the OLEDs or the QLEDs don't need to be really thick, or the upcoming future displays, they don't need to be really thick. The thickness of these displays are few hundreds of nanometers. You can think about how thin they are. So the display itself is transparent. However, the circuit and the PCB behind the display is not transparent. So there is a lot of research going ahead in transparent display. And once the back end of the television is also made transparent, this can be applied instead of windows. We have that the display is transparent. We can see outside. It could be in the planes. It could be in the homes. And when we turn on the display, then it's completely like what we use the television. So that's definitely a part of the path which the television technology is going ahead in.
Man, I'm thinking, you know, in high density housings in New York City, instead of seeing you know, your neighbor's brick wall, you know, you can have like an oceanfront view as you look out the window. That'd be much better.
Yeah, something like Iron Man.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so how about you take us back to where you are now? You're finishing up your PhD, right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
And tell us a little bit more of, before we get to some of the entrepreneurship that, mm-hmm. that you have, tell us a little bit of what you plan on doing next as you move away from Oregon State.
So I'm graduating my PhD. It's end of my fourth year of my PhD, and I'm graduating by end of last week of next month, August of 2018. And I have a position to in Intel in 7-nanometer division, where the group works on developing the process of manufacturing these 7-nanometer processes. And it could be probably called as I-11 process in the future, and that might come up in upcoming several years. So that's the particular group which I will be working for, and I'm really excited to move forward in the same field which I'm going ahead in.
Can I ask another question, actually? Could you give our listeners, especially those who don't consider processors in the size of nanometers, mm-hmm. what does that really mean in terms of computing power? Like, how big is a nanometer, and how big of a deal is it that our technology is moving towards this goal?
So basically, if you think of the first generation of computers, it's as big as the rooms and buildings. And so these in back in the old times, they used transistors and switches for running these computers and the CPU, etc. And with time, the size of transistor starts shrinking, and because of which, the speed and the energy efficiency is improved slowly. And right now, the technology is moving ahead for 7 nanometer as the target in next few years. And eventually, there could be a possibility of single electron transistors. So the smaller the size, the better the memory and the speed and efficiency, energy efficiency, etc. Yeah.
So we're here in the Student Experience Center, and in a previous university I was at, they had old photos of a building that was about this size that they used in the 60s and 70s that they said the entire building was a processor. You'd put in an index card, you know, at 10 o'clock at night as graduate students, and, you know, you'd hope it would run your math, and then the next morning you would come back and find out, oh, there's an error somewhere. But you'd have no idea because it would take literally all night, and, you know, poor graduate students then.
Wow. So the key importance of this progress in the transistor technology or the process or the speed, etc., is not just the design itself, but the process. We should be able to manufacture a few nanometers size of transistor. Each nanometer is like 10 to the minus 9 meters. And we should be able to manufacture such a small devices with a high density. And that's a big challenge as well, along with the design of these transistors only. So that's where a lot of PhDs and researchers are working ahead. And that's my vision to move forward in my career as well.
There's one more thing about your research with the metals and the photons that you were relating to biosensing. Mm-hmm. And we didn't really touch on that, but this is really cool how you're kind of exploiting this thing that happens in order to detect mismatches in DNA. Can you tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that?
So to start with, DNA is double-stranded, as we know, and each strand has set of chemical bonds, G, C, T, A. And when there is a disease or a virus, there could be a mismatch in this DNA, and people want to find what exactly are the mismatches in a DNA. So they take a single-strand DNA, and using that single-strand DNA, people try to find the individual bonds and see the sequence of these bonds on a DNA single strand. So what we do is we use our medium of nanostructures, which have a capability of creating this surface plasma, and we put a single strand DNA of known sequence, attach it to that, and then we pass in another single strand DNA, which we have no idea about the sequence, and it has a quantum dot or something which can emit this light. So what happens is, when we excite these fluorescent-based DNA standards with a high energy light, the electron goes to the higher energy level. When we excite these orbitals, electron goes to the higher energy level, and they recombine to emit some energy in form of a light. So we use this light to find the matches or mismatch of this DNA. So the critical factor for this kind of sensing is the distance between this emitting material and the metal. So we can think of this way. For example, the electron is excited and it's going into the higher energy level. It's like a person in a swimming pool getting onto the dive board. And when the electron falls back, it emits some light. It's like when the person dives from the dive board to swimming pool, there will be a splash of light. So when there is a metal closer to the electron, it cannot emit any light. Because we can think that when a person is diving from a dive board, if there is a net in between, he just jumps into the net, and there is no water splash which comes up. So there is no emission of any light which comes up. So in the same way, when the metal is closer to this electron, it doesn't allow to recombine. It just jumps into the metal, and there is no light. So we use this distance of this fluorophore emitting light and the metal as a key factor. And when there is any mismatch of these DNA standards, the distance changes. So based on the distance, the emission intensity changes. And then we can predict how many mismatches are present in this double-stranded DNA.
So this is something that's currently being done, but with like a huge machine, right? And
yes.
So this is the... what you're doing is really just something that can really advance this technology and make it on a much smaller scale.
So currently the machine used for these is as big as like half of a Mini Cooper, which you can think of. And in our lab, we can make some microchips as big as like 50 by 50 by 50 micrometers in size, which is extremely small than the Mini Cooper. So we use these chips, and we have a capability to measure these light intensity and detect everything using a smartphone, smartphone's camera. And in the next few months, hopefully by end of this year, our lab, our research group will have a capability to do the DNA sensing with a smartphone. So that's an extremely
wow.
compact device for these measurements.
I'm taken aback.
Yeah.
I'm literally speechless.
It's kind of a breakthrough.
Yeah. Well, then I bet we'll have the rest of your lab group on the show as well, so they can
tell us more.
Continue this breakthrough.
I hope they will be here, and I hope they have even better stories.
Well, speaking of stories, let's hear a little bit of how you got to Oregon State, because you didn't just land here in your advisor's lab and do amazing breakthrough science, but you definitely found your way here very carefully. So tell us how you got to Oregon State.
Well, it would have been great to just land here. So to talk about my story, I grew up in a small village back in India, and I had a chance to go for a undergraduate in instrumentation engineering, and that's through inspiration through my uncle, who is a expert and a chief scientist in this area. And I had a chance to take his inspiration and move forward in the undergrad. And in undergraduate, I was working on instrumentation of robotics, and I was hoping to be continuing my future and career in robotics. In the meantime, I had a chance to discuss with my professor, Dr. Larry Cheng, who is right now at Oregon State University. He was at University of Notre Dame, and he recognized my skills in instrumentation, and he had a vision to use these skills in instrumentation of optics and photonics. So I then realized that every single field right now can be utilized in multiple other fields. It's like a hybrid of technologies, instrumentation in robotics or optical or biosensing or photonics, etc. So I had a chance to visit Notre Dame while my undergrad, and I think that just turned my career. It's a stepping stone to my next career. And eventually I had a chance to discuss with my professor, and here I am at Oregon State University. When he moved, then I had to move. And it turned out to be an advantage, and Oregon State University has amazing facilities, and they gave us opportunity to build the labs and come up with new ideas. And I think that turned out really well in the end in terms of my research.
For those of you just joining us, this is Inspiration Dissemination. We're speaking to Akash, and he just described his path to Oregon State and his current place in Dr. Chang's lab. But I'm going to ask you to take a step back and describe an experience that you had, or describe your first experience with Dr. Chang and why he noticed that you were very likely to succeed in graduate school.
So when I was in the University of Notre Dame as an undergraduate fellowship, so Dr. Larry Cheng took me for a fellowship in terahertz circuits and devices, which I don't want to go into more detail. So it's a photonics project. And so it's a very new project which he was trying to pursue in, and he wanted someone to give a try and see to design something new and experiment something new. But the task was to come and learn and accomplish something in span of 8 weeks, which was a very solid challenge for me. And myself being in robotics, photonics, I have no idea. And I had a chance to divide my timeline in 8 weeks. So the first week, I learned everything about what I could about the field. And in the next 5 weeks, I designed and experimented every possible thing I can. I was left with 2 more weeks to summarize all my data and my write-up and the draft. And by the end of my 9th week, probably, when I was back to India, I was able to submit a journal, and which got eventually published in IEEE, one of the IEEE's journals. So that was a task which I came into at day one with no idea about the field. And at end of the 8 weeks, I had a chance to publish a journal. So I think that's what made him feel that I can manage my time, I can learn quickly, I can design really well, I can execute well, and that can be for the future of his lab. So I think that's what made him give me an opportunity wherever, whichever university he was in.
So similar to that experience of stepping into this 8-week fellowship, not knowing anything about photonics, but very quickly having to learn and design and build and experiment and fail and experiment and fail. Mm-hmm. You had a similar experience with, once you have all this data, you have a story together lined up, you have some results, but you had to submit this to a journal, you said.
Yeah.
And tell us about that experience and, you know, maybe some of the frustrations you may have had when submitting to the journal. Because it sounds like, oh, the science is done. Now you just give it to the editor and, you know, off it goes into cyberspace and is published, right?
Yeah. Back when I was an undergrad, to be really honest, when I was given an 8-week of time and I came to U.S. and I obviously wanted to hang out with my friends as well. So at the end of 6 weeks, when I had all the experimental data, which is sufficient for a pretty good journal, I was thinking I'm done. But I eventually realized that's just half of the story. So a researcher is not supposed to just do the survey of the technologies. It's not just finding or designing. It's not just acquiring of data. It's also about summarizing the data and presenting it really well and writing up a complete draft of these journals. And even after that, I was thinking it's done, but it's not done over there yet. We have to find an amazing journal which fits really well and format it accordingly and submit it to the editors and get the feedback from reviewers, and after that modify according to the reviewers' comments and suggestions, and then a particular research gets published. So that's what I had a chance to learn from the entire journey in a span of 8 to 10 weeks. That's one of the major experiences.
But it's not as easy as hitting, you know, Control A on your computer and saying, you know, Times New Roman 12 font, and then submitting that to the journal. Formatting is a bit of a beast, isn't it?
Exactly. So based on my, even right now, I think that researchers have to work only until the point where they can write these journals, because presentation completely depends on the individual skills, and people have to work really hard for presenting not just the content, but apart from that, not beyond that. So but the journal community and the journal publishers expect to be in a solid format, which definitely takes several days back and forth between a student and the professor and professor and the editor. So this is a major challenge I've been watching since years, and eventually I had a stepping stone to solve that issue as well.
So how about you tell us a little bit about that? So you haven't just taken the mm-hmm. backseat here. You're like, oh, I noticed this problem and I'm going to try to do something about it. And there's some really awesome resources here available at Oregon State University for you to do that.
Yes. So 2 years ago, when I had a really good pace of publications, I felt difficulty in formatting journals as well, and I found no solid solutions for these formatting journals or thesis, which is even longer than journals. And I've decided to take over this issue and use it as an opportunity. And However, this wasn't complete as software based, while I am in a nanotechnology or photonics or processing of semiconductors, etc. So apart from that, being an international student, I really was not thinking beyond my research and my job and hoping of getting a job or publishing journals, etc. So one thing which was really pulling me ahead for this and lifting me to not just morally, also in terms of the facilities, is Oregon State University's Accelerator program, which I still find it really amazing. So Accelerator program took me up and taught me from scratch. I'm a researcher who has no idea in business. So Oregon State University's Accelerator took me up and my groupmate, who is now a co-founder of my startup, WiseDoc. So they iterated the idea, they accelerated our move, and then they right now are launching us in this fashion. And over the time, we had a chance to learn the business and the software side and every aspect of a startup. And we are hoping to launch our software in December. So basically what WiseDoc does is it has all the inbuilt templates of all the journals which students require. They just need to open these journals, write up their content, and they can, in span of few clicks or seconds, they can get the final edited journal format which they want to. If the journal is rejected, which happens for 70% of times, no worries, it's taken care of by WiseDoc. In span of few clicks, everything will be transferred into the different journal format which they require, and they can download it. It could be thesis or a journal or anything. So it's no more time based on this formatting journals.
For the listeners who are listening to this and thinking, oh, it's just formatting. You know, you just put a bold thing here and an underlined thing there. And no, for any master students who have not done their thesis yet and submitted to the graduate school, formatting is a beast and a really nonsensical source of frustration and anger that will take you to the end of your will. For PhD students, you have probably already gone through that and thought to yourself, oh my God, I never want to do that again. Instead, I'm going to write in LaTeX or something that does the formatting for you, or you can code in the formatting, because for as simple as Microsoft Word is to open up and use, it stinks at doing any kind of consistent formatting issue. So to have this software coming online in December, WiseDoc, to be able to transfer from a thesis format into a reputable journal format that is also accepted by the editors. And so far, you're going to stick to the engineering fields first to kind of get WiseDoc off the ground and then slowly expand into the other fields of science. But I think this is just brilliant because, again, it's not only the time that it takes to format. Again, this sounds so silly. It's not just the time, but it's the anger and the frustration and just the, oh man, I'm getting worked up thinking about it.
I'm just really anxiously waiting over here for WiseDoc to be up and going and ready for, you know, when I need it. So, and I just want to congratulate you as well for the awards that you have won with WiseDoc. So Akash and his business partner have won the Willamette Innovators Network Shark Tank competition this year. And they were also, which earned them a submission into the Willamette Angel conference. And there they won the speed pitch competition. And so this is has been able to help you develop the startup even more and increase the number of employees you have. So you've gone from 3 to 13, is that right?
Yes. So after the Willamette Angels conference, it was an audience choice award, with the audience being about more than 100 investors. And WiseDoc got more than 80% of the votes, and leading to a audience choice award. And this award is from Palo Alto Research Center. So with this, we had a major exposure, and we had a chance to be part of Corvallis Gazette Times and many other news items. And in span of 2 months, we grew from a team of 3 to a team of 13. And we are actually doing beyond the expected speed of launching. And December is what we are really hoping to launch this product, starting with engineering thesis and eventually spreading across other fields. And hoping to launch this first at Oregon State University and have a chance to give something back.
Oh, all right, all right.
Thank you.
So if any of you want to learn a little bit more about this, you can check out our blog on blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration-dissemination. And there's actually a link to a short video clip that kind of shows you a little bit more how this works. So mm-hmm. it's pretty cool.
So we're coming to the end of our show, and we have two traditions that we ask our guests. The first is we ask for some advice, mm-hmm. and I actually want to ask you for two pieces of advice. One piece of advice is your own choosing, but the second piece of advice is you're now moving on from graduate school. Mm-hmm. This is not your only project that you're an entrepreneur in. You have much bigger plans to start two or three or more and maybe follow in your uncle's footsteps. So please provide mm-hmm. any advice that you have for anyone else who is, you know, finishing a PhD or in the college or in the engineering field. But then also maybe advice for yourself to look back on as you embark on this new and exciting life.
Yes, I think based on my experience, one advice I would give for the undergraduate students to start with is have a big vision and have a big dream. The field which you got into is not the one which we need to confine ourselves. There is a lot bigger issues and to be solved, and have a really big vision. And for graduate students, do not limit your capability until publishing journals or presenting in conferences. Try to convert your research into real products, into real applications, and try to see your research and yourself into in such a position where people are actually using the devices which contains your research. I think that's a sense of accomplishment which will be present for the graduate student community. And for overall, I feel that this world right now with such a pace of increasing in technology, I think it's really important to develop a aggressive style of research or in entrepreneurship as well. So in terms of my progress, this is not my only single startup. I have three more startups coming up with one of it is going to be launched in the next couple of months. And the only reason this happens is because before, when I had a bunch of issues, I think of a bunch of ideas, but I do not have any guts to have a startup. But with OSU Accelerator, what they have done for my career, I think that's now a solid confidence and the fearless situation which I came in, which I'm moving forward in the pace where I am.
Very cool. And just a quick plug there for the OSU Advantage Accelerator Program. That's not just limited to students and faculty and staff at OSU. That's also something available to the broader community. So mm-hmm. definitely a really neat resource that's available here. Mm-hmm. So our second tradition is for you to choose a sound that we're going to outro on. So do you want to tell us what song you chose and why you chose it?
So I chose Eminem, I'm Not Afraid. One reason being, I think music really lifts the spirits up when someone is being really low. And music is something, a very key part for my life in general. And this particular song does the most of it. And the second reason being, it says I'm not afraid, which is what I said, to be fearless in terms of moving ahead to start companies or to get into committed programs like PhD programs, which really need a mindset of being fearless and aggressive pace of working. So these are the reasons I picked this song.
Yeah, I think that very much represents what you've told us about yourself and what we've learned about you. So awesome. All right. So mm-hmm. thank you so much, Akash, for being here. We have very much enjoyed talking to you. And this is Not Afraid by Eminem.
It's been a ride. Everybody, I guess I had to go to that place to get to this one. Now some of you might still be in that place. If you're trying to get out, just follow me. I'll get you. You can try and read my lyrics off of this paper before I lay them, but you won't take this thing out these words before I